local Democrats squabble as more vaccination sites roll out across Duval as a new month begins. Good Monday morning. We are live from Studio 5 on this 1st of March. I'm Melissa Ross. Hope you had a good weekend. Thanks for listening. This is First Coast Connect, and just ahead, a conversation about a lot of things with Jacksonville City Council President Tommy Hazzouri. What are your questions for him? Get on the line now. It's 549-2937. Then later, it's an important heads up. If you've got a four-year-old at home, you need to enroll them in Florida's free voluntary pre-K program. We'll tell you how. But first, this Monday, the latest numbers on the pandemic. The state reports that COVID cases increased over the weekend by more than 5,500. Deaths ticked up too. The total now stands at 30,852. Active hospitalizations did go down a little bit, though. And at the same time, more than 3 million Florida residents have had at least one dose of vaccine to protect them against coronavirus. New vaccination opportunities are opening this month in Jacksonville. We're going to talk about that and a lot of other news as we welcome Jacksonville City Council President Tommy Hazzouri to the show. Tommy Hazzouri, always good to have you. Good morning.
Always good to be on. Thank you, Melissa, and good morning, audience.
And what are your questions for Council President Tommy Hazzouri as we talk vaccinations, local politics, that septic tank phase-out plan the city is working on, and more? It's a freewheeling conversation, lots to cover. 549-2937. Give us a call now. 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open. If I could, let me begin with, as we begin the month of March, Council President Hazzouri, we have a third vaccine that's expected to be delivered to Florida this week, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. It'll join the Moderna and Pfizer products. We've got a new federal vaccination site opening up at the Gateway Town Center this week. How hopeful are you that we will see a big uptick in vaccinations this month across Northeast Florida?
Oh, I think we will. I think we're going to see it all over the country. The third one, I don't want anybody, based on what I've read and seen, anyone to be afraid of Johnson & Johnson's one shot, because it's, you know, another expert, of course. But at 72%, Dr. Fauci said that that's to prevent, you know, deaths and hospitalization, but that they think it's good enough for a 90% or plus comparable to the other two. So, and I've had mine was Pfizer, mm-hmm. and I did mine at the Mandarin Senior Center. My wife and I did 2 or 3 weeks ago, and it's not fail safe. Obviously.
Have you had both doses?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I thought with my lung transplant, I'd be probably among the ones with the first responders at Mayo where I had it. But they said that I needed to wait anyway for a while, and I'm fine. I wasn't, you know, pushing myself because I wanted to make sure that the people that needed to get it right away should. And so I waited my turn and went to Mandarin. Everything has been smooth. I hear more good things about Regency, and I think that the administration and the health department has done an outstanding job, especially the health department, in getting these vaccines out. Would encourage the African-American community not to be afraid. A lot of them are a little hesitant, and others who don't like vaccinations. But, you know, if they get them, the better off. And I think that the president has indicated that he hopes that, you know, there'll be 600 million, I think, opportunities by July. And I would just encourage people to do it as quickly as they can, and hopefully we can do it as smoothly as we can. A lot of it's state-oriented, so, you know, it's up to the state. I thought there were some bad decisions when they just singled out one place on the part of the state, but now I think we're opening the doors for a lot of them, a lot of opportunities and a lot of places to go to.
You mentioned President Biden. I want to ask you about another matter. Of course, over the weekend, former President Trump spoke in Orlando at CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference. That affair has long drawn far-right figures and some with ties to white nationalism. Recently at the Jacksonville City Council, in the chambers, you told a local constituent that he could no longer flash the OK sign when speaking because that is a hand gesture that has ties to white nationalist movements in this country. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Well, Seabird Newsom, who's always been around, he's a nice enough guy, carrying the big Confederate flag against taking down the statues. And he sent me an email the previous weekend asking if he would be arrested if he came up and did some hand gestures, just saluting Trump or whatever. And I was going to answer with an emphatic no, and I decided to talk to General Counsel's office to make sure that what I said was correct and really unsuable. I wanted to make sure that I knew that the council would support me, and I didn't talk to anybody about it. And I wanted to wait, just let him give his little speech and whatever questions he had about whatever bills we may have had. You never know what he's going to come and talk about. And, you know, he addressed stuff, and then when he was leaving, he did his gestures. We had a lunch and learn. Let me preface this. We had a lunch and learn a week before that. Cumber called one, Councilwoman Cumber, and she had a little booklet that showed 50 different signs that people have been making over the past year or two for white supremacy. We don't notice what they are. We're not that familiar with it. One in particular, he does, and that's the one where he raises his hand and holds three fingers and circles his thumb and forefinger. And when he did that, and you know, he prays. I think he praised Rush Limbaugh and Trump, but that's fine. I don't care if he praises him. He does that all the time. Well, at least Trump before Rush Limbaugh passed. But it was signifying to others that he was mocking what his own self, really doing what he did purposely. And when he went to his seat, I made a little statement that and I'm not going to read it here, but I just told them that we don't condone it or support any statement, gesture, or demonstration that discriminates against or disparages any person or group that represents any group that does so. And I could have given him our rule. We do have a council rule that on the speaker cards, it includes requirements on disruptions or certain types of demonstrations. And I didn't want to act on that or read that to him until I saw that something actually happened. So all was well. He went back and made the statement, and it goes for everyone. We're not going to tolerate that, and there's no need to do it. He can speak about what he likes and say what he likes, but please don't hold up hand signals and all that others, maybe not everyone, obviously, but others would look at it and the terms that especially, well, black and white, that he's expressing his support for white supremacy. I don't know how true that is, but I'm not going to take a chance that his intentions were to do just that.
Lots of material to get through. We're speaking with City Council President Tommy Hazzouri. We'll go to your calls in a moment at 549-2937. Let me ask you about another recent controversy, allegations of secret meetings and a potential backdoor deal involving local Democratic Party Chairman Daniel Henry and your colleague on the City Council, Republican Rory Diamond. You and other Democrats have called for your local party chair to resign. You've also called for your colleague Rory Diamond on the City Council to be admonished for a meeting that happened between these two. And this had to do with redistricting and new census data that's expected to come out this fall. And the battle over redistricting districts, legislative and other districts in Florida. So why are you calling for both of these gentlemen to be either censured or removed from their post?
Well, I'm not as embedded. I'm a Democrat, and I support the Democrats' positions and have been all my life. But what Daniel Henry did as chairman, and I like him a lot, met with Rory Diamond, who is a Republican, and that's fine. The party stuff doesn't bother me, but when it crosses a line of redistricting, for example, that's very sacred. That's very public.
What do we know happened at this meeting?
Allegedly, and Mr. Dennis and others seem to know more about that. He met, and he owned up to it. I'm talking about Daniel, and let me just make sure that the public understands, we acted quickly and methodically and told him he needed to step down because he violated, first of all, dealing with redistricting. Roy Diamond tried to talk him into maybe running for Randy DeFore's seat, who's a Republican who I like very much, but Randy, a fellow Republican, and help redraw the district where he could run if he wanted to or what have you. And I think it's more of a dislike for Randy and whatever, but that's, you know, that's his personal opinion. He's very, that's the way he operates. And could be that I don't want to get into personal things. He's kind of a troublemaker in his own right. He had no business doing that, first of all. He violated his own, and this is where I was coming from. Roy violated his own oath to support his party, but more importantly, he's going into redistricting, which he's not on the committee, every council member and every school board member. This redistricting is just for the two of us, the two entities, school board and us, not the legislature, not any of this other stuff, not congressional, which Roy would like to run for Congress. But I think it was more of a self-serving issue that he wanted to do. But he's going to vote, and this is what, and that's why I think that the Republican Party, I think this is bigger than Daniel. I think it's the Republican Party's, we acted responsibly in asking his resignation, in asking Daniel's resignation. The Republican Party needs to step up and do the same thing. Maybe not ask for the resignation, that's their call, but to admonish Roy, because he's going to vote.
Is that really likely, though? Is that likely? I mean, do you honestly, let's be realistic, that's probably not going to happen. So are you?
Well, let me just finish. I think, Melissa, I think it's important that they know he's voting on redistricting. He's an elected council member who has a vote, like every other 18 members, as well as the 7 school board members. So he's voting on something that he's encouraging the lack of transparency and undermining the redistricting process. That's a very sacred issue for all of us. And to do it right and to do it equitable.
Okay.
He's going in there and trying to break that up, and that's not going to stand with me.
And
that will not stand.
And not to cut you off, but just want to get a few callers in. We are speaking with Jacksonville City Council President Tommy Hazzouri. Now, when we booked the council president last week, the big topic we had planned to lead off with was septic tank phase-outs across the county. But, of course, news is always moving forward. But let's take a minute to talk about that. 549-2937. Mark on the west side. Hi, Mark. Good morning.
Good morning. Mr. Hazzouri, I'm kind of perplexed. I see that we've been spending a lot of time and a lot of money trying to get these old septic tanks removed and put people on city sewerage, but at the same time we're doing this, whole neighborhoods are being built with septic tanks, and it just dry and in poor positions, like right next to waterways. And I've got some in my own neighborhood they just put up a year ago, right next to a creek, and we're spending all this money to get all these bad septic tanks out. Meanwhile, we're putting more in. So what's going, what does the left hand know what the right hand is doing? What's going on?
Yeah, I mean,
no, we're doing,
that's a great question. I mean, our new, how many new homes are still being built this way? Thank you for that, Mark. Go ahead, Tommy.
No, some developers where they can't put in water and sewer, city water and sewer, are doing the septic tanks. These septic tanks obviously don't violate the health, safety, and welfare of the community. They're brand new. They're done with the most modern approach. I asked our Public Works Department why they still have an opportunity to do that, and he said they have always been able to, and there's no law preventing that. Our deal is, and our responsibility is, to protect the health, safety, and welfare. And right now, we have 65,000 septic tanks that exist in Jacksonville today. No new, I'm not counting all the new development or any of that. And 22,250 consists of 35 neighborhoods that it's going to cost us over $1 billion in addressing. These failed septic tanks have fecal matter that seeps into the system. They impact the environment. a number of things that that demonstrate that they're going to that these septic tanks are not working. They don't have water and sewer. And what we're doing, and it's long past due, especially in the older neighborhoods, and they've identified, the health department's given us the list, and we concur. What they're doing is, what we're trying to do is we're going to connect them for free where you don't have to pay. And if it takes 70%, I think, of the neighborhoods to sign a petition to agree to do that. And if we do it, and we were able to have the funds to go in there, then we're going to go in there, replace them, hook them up, do it, everything we need, and then the citizens will pay their monthly water and sewer bill. That would be new to them. If they don't choose to do it, even though 70% have signed up and we've started, then they're going to have to pay the going price for the hookup. So it would be beneficial for those who haven't hooked up or who choose not to do so, to save them a lot of money. I think it's important that the city gets behind this and find a source of revenue. It's long past due. Since pre-consolidation, they've made promises that have been unfulfilled that we need to take care of.
And when you talk about revenue, where is that revenue going to come from?
That's the next question. The mayor's working on, I filed a bill previously that, couple weeks ago, that calls for $100 million coming out of our CIP that we would borrow from the Capital Improvement Fund to begin immediately and not kick the can further down the road and to start. And $100 million is not a drop in the bucket, quite frankly, obviously, because it's going to cost us over $1 billion just for the for top 35 on the list that they have, not 35, but the 35 neighborhoods, and were the most issues are the failed septic tanks. But on top of that, the mayor is looking on a long-term basis, and he said it will take a while. That's why I want to go ahead and do a jump start. The next one that's on the list is Riverview, which is $92 million, and that's the fourth one that he's already taken care of, that are starting to fund the top three with the JEA, and that's being done in Biltmore and Crystal Ball and Beverly Hills. So that's going to be addressed. He's going to be having to look for money. He's looking at the next, and this may take up too much time.
Yeah. If I may, let me get a few more folks on.
For the gas tax. So, okay. And that's where he's looking to get the other money, but only generate $300 million. So that if they pass my 100, that's 400, and we need well over $1 billion.
Well over a billion.
Just to
get started, this gives you an idea of the immense challenge Jacksonville faces. Calls about this for Council President Tommy Hazzouri. Marlena is in Arlington. Marlena, happy March. Go ahead.
Happy March. Hi, Tommy. Councilman Hazzouri, thanks for taking my call, guys. So I live in Clifton, which is one of the oldest neighborhoods in Jacksonville. And my house is on the river. I have a septic system that's been there since it was built in 62. Now, twice a year, the JEA water treatment pump station that is closest to us over here in Arlington, right off of University, it overflows twice a year into the channel that is behind my house. And we end up getting put on a don't fish advisory for the overflow that happens. I want to know if that's being addressed, because JEA just keeps paying the fine every time it fails, but I'm going to be asked to change my septic system that's not doing that to our river. So just wanted to ask.
Yeah, sorry to hear that. Yeah, yeah, lots of people in her situation or something similar.
If you could, yeah, well, I don't know where it is on the list, but that's related to septic tanks, not your issue. I can address that with Public Works and the JEA. JEA, by the way, is going to have to, it's a three-legged stool. They're going to have to play a major role in the funding and the new systems. They're doing a study that should be finished soon on a more economic way to put in the septic tanks, where they're doing nationwide, and will save us even considerably more money, plus the city council, plus the mayor. So that's the three-legged stool that's going to have to participate. Let me, if you can call 255-5815, and Amber, my President's Secretary, will answer and will take care of following up and talking to you and getting more detail, if that's okay. And I don't know the background. I know that I've talked to a couple of people over in Arlington. And plus, I want to get Joyce Morgan, Councilwoman Morgan, involved. I don't know if you've talked to her, to making sure, and Ron Salem, who's at large but lives in the Arlington area. So we'll address that. Just let me know and call that number, and we'll be glad to follow up on it.
All right.
Thank you for telling us that problem.
Hannah in Jacksonville Beach. Hello, Hannah. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning.
I wanted to say I am not, I'm totally disappointed because the only winners in this are the Republican Party. I'm the Beaches Democratic Club Vice President, and I'm treasurer of the DEC. And so I have a vested interest in this from the inside. Daniel was at the helm of the party when Duval turned blue, and he said quite apparently that he rejected this nefarious, shady, alleged offer, and he never would have negotiated this. So I'm not sure why his point of view, as one of the two people in the room who had the conversation, is being repositioned as a negotiation when he rejected it. And also, the main issue is that we need to defend our councilman, Garrett Dennis's work in redistricting, and this intra-party fighting makes it almost impossible. Because we need to defend that, because it became apparent that the Republican Party will dismiss it when Tommy's no longer president. And I feel that Tommy should be defending Garrett and Daniel in this. And I don't understand why this position is taken to have him resign for something that didn't happen, as far as I'm concerned.
All right, Hannah. Are the local Democrats engaging in a circular firing squad, Tommy Hazzouri?
You know, it's the elected officials that have the biggest concern. If they went to the full committee, which is 160, I think, you know, he may very well be, you know, kept in office, whatever. I don't want to see the disarray. I don't think there has to be. I think the responsible way is the way we did it, and asking for the resignation by others getting involved now.
What about her point, though, that nobody knows what happened in that meeting except the two of them?
Well, that's why. That's
I mean,
why
is it against the law to meet
that's
with?
That's why a problem
to meet
well,
with someone.
Daniel Henry's already said what he did.
Okay,
and he said he did. He said he was blindsided, but he did do that. And Roy, of course, in his nature, it's his nature to deny everything. And I'm not just picking on him. I just have seen his M.O. over the last couple of years that he's been on the council.
And so, for the record, he has denied this. This is what took place.
Yes, yeah. And I didn't expect him to do otherwise. He's that, I hate to say, that kind of a person. But I'm not here to judge. It happened, and Daniel Henry has said it has happened. He said that he didn't know it was going to happen, and Roy deliberately went out there.
Well, why not
to do
take
what he did.
Daniel Henry at his word?
Excuse me.
Why not take Daniel Henry at his word?
That he knew it.
That he went into. Yeah, exactly.
He had a couple of meetings with them. One was another tour. He knew. He was tempted. It may have been an ego thing. Mm. It's not about that. It's not my judgment. I'm basing it on information that who are party participants a lot, who knows. And I know I talked to Daniel. I know Garrett Dennis did. I know others have. And they seem to think. And you know what? It's internal stuff. I think it's not about, you know, if it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen. But it's not about taking his word over the others. I think that we have to be the, you know, we have to give the benefit of the doubt to the party and to the action. When you're dealing with reapportionment, you're walking on dangerous grounds. If the people don't trust what we're doing and you're drafting and you know what's happened with gerrymandering and all, and that's exactly what Roy Diamond was asking them, and if I had to bet, my concern is not Daniel anymore. The greater concern for me is that the party, the Republican Party, allowed that to happen. And if they don't take action on it, then shame on them. And I'd say the same thing about the Democrats. We acted swiftly, and I think that was important, and responsibly, in order to make sure that the integrity of the redistricting and reapportionment takes place. And Roy goes out and tries to undermine that. And as an elected official, as a city council member who will vote on redistricting when the time comes, just like everybody will, all 19 council members and 7 school board members. And I don't want there to be any kind of a taint on that process or anyone challenging the integrity of what we're doing. And that's exactly what Rory Diamond did. And he's been wanting to, and there's more to the story. He's been wanting to upstart my committee that Garrett Dennis heads up, that has Brenda Priestley Jackson, Randy White, Randy DeFore, and Reggie Gaffney on it. And I think that they've done a great job so far. You know, we're not going to be the ones to end up, it's going to go into the next presidency, but we're laying the groundwork for when census comes out, which they've delayed now until I think next September, before we can even vote on this. And so we're laying the good groundwork, working with OGC,
all
Jerry
right.
Holland,
and
others, and it's working.
Well, I want to thank you. We covered a lot of ground in this half hour, so thank you for joining us. We'll follow up with Councilman Diamond to see if he'd like to respond to some of this at a certain point.
Well, good luck with that.
And thank you so much, Tommy Hazzuri, president of the Jacksonville City Council. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. Thank you, Melissa, and thank you, audience. Appreciate it.
All right. Much more still ahead later. We'll tell you how you can shine a light on the unsung local heroes you know that have helped others in this pandemic. That's later, but up next.
The voluntary pre-kindergarten program is an early education program for all children who are 4 years old as of September 1st.
We'll tell you how to enroll your child in Florida's free VPK program. That's after this. Well, if you're the parent of a four-year-old, listen up. Voluntary pre-K enrollment is underway right now. Now, this is a free early learning program. Studies show early learning makes a real difference in your child's brain development and their academic performance over time. I spoke about it with Denise Marzullo, CEO of the Early Learning Coalition of Duval. Hey, Denise. Great to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It seems like a little ways off, but you want to get the word out now that registration is open for voluntary pre-kindergarten, VPK, for the upcoming school year. So all the families out there with a four-year-old need to apply. Tell us about this opportunity.
So the voluntary pre-kindergarten program is an early education program for all children who are 4 years old as of September 1st. Of that school year and live in the state of Florida. So it is a free program. It provides up to a certain number of hours of instruction for children, preparing them for kindergarten. So getting those early literacy, phonological awareness, all those skills that children need to be ready for kindergarten.
Yeah. And Florida was one of the first states in the country to offer voluntary pre-K for all four-year-olds, regardless of income. Floridians have really taken advantage of this. Can you talk about why early learning is so critical to child development? This is what the Early Learning Coalition of Duval focuses on.
Yeah, so we know research shows that 90% of a person's brain is developed in the first 5 years of life. So that's significant brain development that's occurring. So their brains are little sponges, just ready to absorb as much information as they can. And so having early education programs literally starting from infancy on up is really critical as that brain is developing. They're recognizing social cues. They're learning, you know, sounds and all of those things that really build up their vocabulary. Also, it's really important that children get that social development in those early years. They learn how to interact with other children their age. They learn how to problem solve. They learn, you know, how to how to resolve conflict, you know, all of those things that are so critical for when they start school.
How widely used is Florida's VPK program? How many parents are taking advantage of it?
Excellent question. So we average about 76% of our four-year-olds are attending a VPK program. So we still have some work to do. We'd like that to be 100%. So we do a lot of outreach, including, you know, talking with you and really kind of helping the community to understand the importance and the value of this free program. Oftentimes we hear things are free, so we think they don't have a value, but it's free because it is so valuable. Our legislators recognized years ago the importance of early education, and they wanted to make that available to all four-year-olds. They recognized that regardless of income, children need that early learning foundation prior to starting kindergarten, and that the success of a child really begins at it so early on. And the research has just shown, you know, that third grade reading levels for children who attended a VPK program are higher than those that don't. And so it really is critical that, you know, we continue to get as many children enrolled in our VPK programs as possible.
Now, of course, parents are interested in a high quality preschool for their 4-year-old, but they might not know how to find the best choice for their child. You have helped parents in Northeast Florida get a better handle on where the best opportunities are. So say you're a parent of a 4-year-old, you don't even know where to begin, what type of preschool to put your child in. How can you decide where's the best facility for my child?
Sure. So one of the most important parts of our early learning system is that it's all based on parental choice. So parents can choose any one of our over 600 VPK contracted providers. That includes private centers, family child care homes, public schools. Some public schools have VPK. Faith-based centers have VPK. And so there are lots and lots of options. So parents, the best way to go is to either call us, 904-208-2044, or they can go on our website, elcduval.org. And there's lots and lots of information, including a directory of contracted providers. So they can find one that's close to them. They can see if they participate in our Guiding Stars of Duval quality rating system. They can see how many stars that they have earned, and that's based on their measure of quality. They can call us to get more information about providers. We also on our website have a link to the DCF website, which shows the health and safety violations or lack thereof, hopefully, for our centers. And so there's a lot of information either on our website or just by calling us. And then I encourage parents to go and visit, you know, visit a couple of centers that they're thinking about that they, you know, might want to take their child to. Talk to the teachers who were there. Talk to the directors. We have a list of questions that parents might want to ask. So our website really is a plethora of resources to help guide parents through this process, because if this is your first time having a four-year-old, you have no idea sometimes, like, what do I even ask? What do I look for? So all of that is available on our website. And I really do encourage parents to go and visit the centers and talk to the VPK teachers and learn about what curriculum they're using, what kind of behavioral supports do they have. All of those things are really important in making this type of decision.
Check it out, parents. It's free, and it's time to enroll your 4-year-old in voluntary pre-K. Denise Marzullo, President and CEO of the Early Learning Coalition of Duval. Thanks, Denise.
Thank you.
Well, a new report in the Florida Times-Union last week looked at the role students played in getting Duval County Public Schools to amplify Black History Month. It is the 1st of March, but let's take a quick look back at this. Emily Block, education reporter for the TU, covered this story, and she's on the line. Hey, Emily.
Hi, Melissa.
Good to talk to you. This was fascinating, how students rose up around Duval County and really forced the school district to change its position. How did all of this get started?
Sure, and absolutely. It was a big movement that we saw over the course of a month. So at the beginning of the month,
really what started this was a failed campaign by Duval Schools. The district started a campaign to raise mental health awareness and suicide awareness, but it was called You Matter Month, and it had a hashtag about taking off your figurative mask and being able to talk to adults about the issues that you're having if you're dealing with anything. Parents took issues with that immediately. Faculty took issue with that immediately with the hashtag saying, why are we doing this during a pandemic? From there, the district responded saying that they were going to, you know, rephrase their language and pivot a bit. But it was still You Matter Month. So they focused the campaign on that. Almost immediately, within the first week of schools posting about You Matter Month in the high school messaging boards that they use, students were taking issue with, February is Black History Month. Why are we naming a new month now out of the blue and launching a new month when we, you know, Black students are saying, when we only get this 1 month a year to recognize our history? So immediately they are taking issues with the timing, especially pointing out that Suicide Prevention Week takes place in September. There are other mental health months throughout the year. Additionally, the students took issue with the language, saying you matter, and that emphasis on matter sounds a lot like all lives matter, sounds a lot like the district could be possibly deflecting Black Lives Matter into a all lives matter situation. The district immediately mea culpa and said that's not what we were trying to do, and had to really step back and rethink this whole campaign. And that's what pushed everything off.
And then on February 10th, you report students at Sandalwood High walked out, and that prompted other student walkouts around town. Yes?
Right. So that angst about the messaging and the platform sparked walkouts across the district. It started at Sandalwood High on February 10th with a walkout that was at 12:30, walked out of their classrooms. They walked to the cafeteria area, and they had a peaceful protest. From there, students chattered on social media. They mobilized together. Students that had never talked to each other before from across different high schools in the district and wanted to have their own protests. So across the district, there were different protests in solidarity, asking the district to rethink You Matter Month and also emphasize Black history taught in the curriculum year-round.
Let's talk about that, because a number of the students told you they feel that the school district and Jacksonville in general doesn't do a good job of telling its own story and the true giants that played a role in African-American history, like James Weldon Johnson, who wrote the Black National Anthem, Lift Every Voice and Sing, from Jacksonville. A. Philip Randolph from Jacksonville. He basically created the 1963 March on Washington. He was the founder of the sleeping car Pullman Porters, one of the first Black unions in America. And Axe Handle Saturday. Kids don't know the history of that event that happened downtown during the height of the Civil Rights Movement. So is the school district going to respond to these entreaties from the kids and start teaching this curriculum as part of local history?
Right. Student after student, I kept hearing the same issue, no matter what school they went to, which was that they were learning about their local Black history from relatives, from the internet, from TikTok, from museums, but not in their classrooms. And they didn't understand why. A lot of them actually, I mean, these are really mature students. These are high school students that are very well involved with their community, with their neighborhoods. They know that to an extent, schooling has to do with testing and benchmarks. So they understand, and they weren't necessarily placing the blame on one teacher. They really understood that, like, if a teacher is going the extra mile, that's what they're doing. They're going the extra mile. They understood that a lot of this comes from a state level, but they're trying to work with the district to make sure that there is an emphasis on Black history and local Black history in classrooms. And the district is responding. So there's already an African American task force that was set up prior to all this, that was set up last year, and has really been trying to hone in and talk to the students that are upset about what they can do to better integrate Black history into the curriculum that already exists in schools.
So it's really remarkable to see that the district did listen and did respond. How gratifying has that been for these young student activists?
The students are cautiously optimistic. They're excited to be heard. Dr. Diana Green, the superintendent of Duval Schools, has already initiated some meetings with the students that led the movement from across the district.
And I know that they're really encouraged by that. They feel like they're being listened to and that they're being taken seriously and validated. At the same time, they know that there's a lot going on that's outside of their control. An example they gave to me were the renaming of schools. The students that I spoke to are in full support of these schools being renamed. They also know that there are 23 or 24 district community meetings that are all about renaming schools. And they feel like, okay, but what about everything else that we're pointing out, you know? So they understand that there's bureaucracy involved and there's going to be, it's going to be a long path. That's not going to be instant gratification all the time.
So now that Black History Month is over, as you reflect back on this really extraordinary story, it's remarkable to see young people, teenagers, young adults, really flexing and speaking out in a way that they hadn't before. This is a cultural change, Emily, that has been really fascinating to watch.
I completely agree. I think one of the students, Mikayla Cooper, that I spoke to, who has been a really prominent voice in the district, she attends Lee, I believe, off the top of my head. Yes, she's a senior at Lee, and she called it a mustard seed of faith. She said, we started with a mustard seed of faith, and now we're watching it grow. And that really stuck with me the whole time that I was reporting on this. I think she's absolutely right that this started as one seed that was planted, and suddenly we're seeing this youth movement across all of the high schools. So it has been really remarkable.
Always good to get your insights and your great reporting on this program. Emily, thank you so much for stopping by. We appreciate it.
I appreciate you. Thanks, Melissa.
Emily Block, education reporter at the Florida Times Union. More at jacksonville.com. And in a moment, do you know someone who's really done some amazing work in this pandemic, who's helped others? Do you have an unsung hero you'd like to see be recognized? After the break, we're going to tell you how you can nominate them to get some well-deserved recognition. Something positive coming out of this challenging time as we speak with Leadership Jacksonville. That's coming up. A quick break, but first, you're listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9. We'll be right back.
Celebration of Henry Louis Gates Jr.'s new documentary, The Black Church, WJCT is collecting stories and memories of your experiences. What does the Black Church mean to you? What role has it played in your life? Share your thoughts and memories and have your stories archived for future generations. Visit wjct.org/blackchurch for instructions.
March is Women's History Month. I'm Ben Brookmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll visit the historic home of businesswomen Carrie and Ella Rossiter. We'll discuss women's suffrage and race with Connie Lester, editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly, and talk about historic structures in Edenville. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Marco Werman. On The World, we get an outside perspective.
I love lots of things about Russia.
We all share the love for Syria.
Because getting outside yourself can be a good thing.
The act of empathy is fundamentally an act of imagination. Somebody says to me, Kwame, I can't imagine what you go through as a black person. And I'll say, try.
It is The World.
Today at 3 on WJCT News 89.9.
Despite loans and pivots and going online, some micro business owners say it's not enough to stay afloat.
Definitely feel a little lost in the shuffle. I think that the banks are looking at these small micro businesses as a risk, but we're the ones that really need the support the most.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, trying to run a two-person beauty bar in Denver, next time on Marketplace.
Tomorrow evening at 6 on WJCT News 89.9.
President Biden is upbeat that we could soon have a third vaccine, and he's ready to push go.
If the FDA approves the use of this new vaccine, we have a plan to roll it out as quickly as Johnson & Johnson can make it.
The technology driving this treatment is different and requires just a single dose. I'm Jen White. Dr. Fauci answers your questions next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Do you know an unsung hero who's helped others in this pandemic? If so, you should nominate them so they can get some recognition. Here's Jill Dame, CEO of Leadership Jacksonville. Hi, Jill. Good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me, Melissa.
Now, we want to get the word out about something that's going on with LJ in this time of COVID. You are looking to honor people who have been leaders in this pandemic, right?
We are. We're coming up on our annual celebration fundraising event, and at that event, we usually honor community trustees. Well, this has been such an unusual year. So many unusual people have stepped up in different ways to help others in the community during the pandemic. So we'd like to recognize some of those stories at our event, instead of our standard recognition of some of our alumni. So that's why I'm here today, to talk about those nominations and to get folks to submit some great stories for us.
So you're asking the whole community to think of someone that they think would be worthy of honoring. This could be anybody, right?
Right. It sure could. It could be a youth that set up a lemonade stand to raise money for mask for people that didn't have face mask. It could be, I know there's some students that actually made face mask for lots of people. We're looking for different stories. We're calling them the unsung COVID leaders, people that have stepped forward, not for their own self-interest, but to do good things for others in the community during this time.
And they'll be honored virtually, right? Tell us a little bit more about that.
Exactly. Yeah, our fundraising event will air. It will premiere on YouTube on May 25th, so we've got a little bit of time. But after we receive the nominations, we will look and pick some of the more interesting stories, the more unusual stories, and do a little video that talks about what these folks have done. A lot of the honorees or the nominees will be listed in our program, and their names might appear in the video, but we'll be sharing on the virtual evening celebration, we'll be sharing some of those stories that we will have videoed. So we will not only hear from the people, but we'll see them that night and let them tell their stories.
So how can people submit their unsung COVID hero names to you at Leadership Jacksonville?
It is a online nomination. Our website is www.leadershipjax.org. And at the bottom of the homepage, there's a nominate here button that they go to, and they'll be asked to give factual information about the person, how we contact them, what the story is, maybe a reference for the story. If it's someone that you work with, who's another person that could add to the story or tell the story? If it's been highlighted already in the media, if there's a link to that story that we could look at and read for more information, all online, and they're due to us by March 5th, which is coming up, but people have time. It's not a lengthy application. Online, they submit it, and then we'll go from there to evaluate and select some folks to honor at celebration.
All right. So leadershipjacks.org, nominations due Friday, March 5th. And then one more question, Jill. Coming out of this pandemic, a new generation of leaders should soon be rising in this city. Tell us a little bit about how you plan to steer Leadership Jacksonville into this coming decade as we transition out of this time we're all in and hopefully come through it okay, but face new challenges for the community.
Absolutely. Well, we have continued during the pandemic to run our programs. In fact, our youth program is the recipient of our fundraising for our celebration event. The youth program has been virtually with Zoom sessions, continuing to educate, connect, and inspire high school students to do more, to make a difference. And it's a lot more real to them when they've seen the impact that this pandemic has had on their family, their friends, their classmates. They're even more eager to get out there and make a difference in our community. Likewise, we've continued to prepare our adult leaders through virtual sessions to join other organizations, other people, and make a difference to bring Jacksonville back even stronger. But we've spotted some of our weaknesses during the pandemic, and these folks have talked about them and are eager to lend their hands and their voices to improving our community.
Well, thanks so much, Jill Dame, CEO of Leadership Jacksonville. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa. I sure appreciate it.
And that's our show. So get to nominating, everybody. Thanks so much for listening, and thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is show director. Station news director is Jessica Palumbo. Bill Bordsfield is our digital editor. Keep your feedback coming. We always appreciate it. Send those emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. You can listen to our podcast up later today, wherever you like to listen, or always listen through the WJCT app. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great Monday.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.